Good evening. Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, July 24th, 2001. In the fireside room this evening is Steve Gramsch. Today's session number is GRS 2001-02 and is titled Science and the Western Intellectual Tradition. Let's listen in.
I want to today sort of do something a little bit different. But at the end of yesterday's session, what I wanted to get across was the importance of this this idea of a paradigm or a way, a framework for understanding and also communicating scientific discoveries. Someone who studies science for a living, like I do, or does science for a living, has to sometimes step back and realize that there are many different traditions of knowledge that have been that we use, so different types of wisdom that we use from different cultures. And that puts one in the position, I think, of not apologizing, but sort of apologizing for the fact that we restrict ourselves to this Western tradition. Because, in fact, it's the Hellenistic tradition that I'll go into a little bit today, and then later European tradition, is where we really first saw the flourishing of science, and so this idea of a paradigm, this idea that one can take a certain method, for lack of a better word, of doing your work and communicating your results, turns out to be extremely important and throughout the discussion. And the reason for that is I think will become very clear later on tomorrow and the next day, when we really talk about how certain ideas have come to play a large role in our own thinking. Things like the theory of evolution, things like the age of the Earth, which are tremendously active areas of scientific research even now, and have not gotten any less active as a result of controversy. And one can argue whether scientists are immune to this sort of criticism or not, but it's only, in my opinion, it's only sort of fueled the fire, so to speak. Anyway, today what I'd like to do is to go through sort of a thumbnail sketch of the history of scientific thought from the Hellenistic period to the early Middle Ages, with a focus on how Christianity came to play a role in the transmission and the sort of keeping scientific thought alive. One of the greatest things about history to me is to be able to go back and to sort of try to put yourself into a situation or a time period right after a tremendous cataclysmic event. For example, what was it like to be an early Christian in the days and years, you know, immediately following the crucifixion, for example? Or what was it like to be in Germany right after the spring of 1945, you know, when there was no power for 3 or 4 months or something like that? What was it like to be in those situations? And reading through some of the things that I'm going to talk about today, I kind of got a sense of that, of how really special a time it was, I think, and I hope that I can convey a little bit of that to you today. And I promise I won't fire a scientific problem at you today like I did yesterday, but I will on Thursday. We will attack another scientific problem, so you have prior warning. But the scientific problem on Thursday is extremely fundamental, and we'll attack it as a group, and I think it'll be kind of fun. But anyway, so I'm going to speak a little bit more sort of in a continuous format, but if you have any comments or questions or anything, just feel free to raise your hand and we can address things. But there's a few things that I want to talk about, and then we'll kind of get into a discussion about it. I mentioned yesterday the Timaeus, and I want to just revisit that for a moment. I want to emphasize the fact that that really was a revolutionary text for two reasons. Plato had in mind, really, a new way of trying to communicate some of his ideas. And one has to remember that up to that point, that Greek ideas about the origin of the world and sort of the order of the cosmos were really kind of reproduction stories. So-and-so begat so-and-so with and gods and heroes and things like that. And what it was really was undesigned development, sort of from material origins, is the way I like to think of it. Sort of reproduction and growth, but sort of that type of format. Plato worked from the premise that, and this disturbed him, and the reason it disturbed him was because it denied any sort of intelligence. It was just sort of the spurious behavior of the gods, and that he was in the position of refuting that. Now, if you think back to what happened with Socrates not so many years before, he was put to death for much the same sort of behavior. So one has to remember that this represents a real revolution in the thinking of the day. And so what Plato does in the Timaeus is that he postulates a creator. Now, this creator is not an omnipotent God like the Hebrew tradition. What it is more of an assistant. And he doesn't equate this creator with Zeus at all. So this creator is what he calls the prime mover. And this prime mover is responsible for making order out of chaos. Now, the previous sort of tradition made Zeus, or the predecessors of Zeus, really responsible for all this. And they, you know, this god or this titan battled with this titan and, you know, threw him into the ocean, and then sort of non-intelligent type of origins. And so it was revolutionary for that reason. The other reason it was revolutionary was because his explanation laid out the workings of the natural world by appealing to geometric or mathematical reason. And so there's the two things that he is really interested in here is intelligence and reasoning. And so this is a new wave sort of in the thinking of the day. And that the issues that he addresses, he doesn't address all issues in knowledge of the day, but he does address a number of the most important ones, and these are theology, that is to say, the origins of the world and divinity, philosophy, how we know things, how we know ourselves, astronomy, cosmology, what is the stuff of the earth, what is it made of, how did it get there, the structure of matter, one of the things that we talked about a little bit yesterday, and then also psychology and physiology. Now, naturally, if one reads through the Timaeus, it's almost like a caricature the latter parts, the psychology and physiology, but of course, what did they have to work with? I mean, it's much less developed in that way. But if we really look at it very closely, what we find is that we have the seeds of the scientific method in there. What is that? That is questioning, that is hypothesis, that is trying to order the phenomenon in the material world. The experimentation aspect really wasn't there as much as in later years, so one had to really pretty much go on observation only. But the thing that really is interesting about this to me is what happened later. And if you recall, Aristotle came later, was the student of Plato, but the thing that was really important about Aristotle was that he was employed by Philip of Macedon as the tutor for Alexander the Great. Now, Alexander didn't appear to be all that interested in the ordering of the universe, or he appeared to be more interested in military tactics and how to get the most out of his soldiers. But in the end, the effect of this really was his far-flung empire. He had outposts everywhere, 11 cities named Alexandria, and that diffused this Greek way of thinking into what we call the Hellenistic world. And that really is one of the most important aspects of the legacy of Greek science. I mean, we know that Athens particularly went into decline after Alexander conquered it. But in these outposts of the Macedonian Empire, or the Hellenistic world, one has these amazing flourishing of scientific knowledge. And I want to just point out two examples. So the first, I'll try to develop kind of a little bit of a timeline here. The first one, of course, we had Plato, approximately, you know, flourishing in about 380 BC. But later on, and of course we're kind of skipping over the traumatic events of the early Roman Empire here, but I'll get back to that. But one of the most important was Ptolemy. And Ptolemy was in Alexandria, and was also flourishing about 150 AD. We know that the world was changing rapidly in between there, and of course this diffusion of knowledge was happening all of this time. But the most important thing about Ptolemy was that he was able to, his main idea was planetary motion. And what he really wanted to do was describe the motion of the planets mathematically. Now, where else would you want to go if you really want to understand the mathematics of geometrical forms and motion than Egypt? Somebody mentioned yesterday that they had the most marvelous geometry in all of the ancient world, and that stayed there for a long, long time. And Ptolemy was benefited greatly by being exposed to that kind of knowledge. And so he was able to put together, using mathematics, with geometry in particular, but put together a system for the cosmos, and specifically planetary motion, which really described everything, but had the Earth at its center. Now we know, of course, that that's not true, but the fact that he was able to do it, he had a special motion for each planet that was fully consistent. I mean, it predicted everything. And it wasn't until well into the Renaissance, really, that people really started to believe, of course, that the sun was the center of our particular solar system. And I think that's striking, really. To me, it's amazing that this type of building on previous knowledge and getting together this type of model of the cosmos that was fully consistent, even though it was wrong, is amazing to me. Just really striking. And it points, I think, to one of the most important aspects of science, and that is that Ptolemy transmitted his findings, and he was able to write down his reasonings, and that people eventually were able to refute those reasonings, but in a scientific way, knowing what his premises were, knowing what the conclusions he drew from them, and then finally being able to refute them in a way that made complete sense. Eventually, Copernicus, of course, was responsible for overturning that. But the other person who we want to just mention briefly was a man by the name of Galen, and he was around about the same time, approximately 200 AD, in the city of Pergamum, in what is now what is then Asia Minor, what is now Turkey, and his field was medicine, and it was. This is kind of a case of the right person in the wrong place at the wrong time, really, because he had such new ideas about the function of organs and how they work together, as opposed to sort of spirits in the body. He did subscribe to the idea of the four humors. And the ideas of disease being imbalances of these humors. And you probably still kind of believe in that today in some respects, not scientifically, of course, but in one way or another, it really is kind of intuitively a good idea. But he was, unfortunately, in a situation where dissection of human bodies was no longer acceptable practice. Prior to his time, people did it quite often and learned a great deal about the constitution of the body. But by the time he arrived on the scene, you couldn't do that anymore. It was sacrilegious. And so he was reduced to dissecting monkeys. Now, one would think that that's probably a reasonable substitute, and in fact, he wound up was the first person really to start thinking about. Wasn't the person who proved it, but started thinking about how organs work together, and disease being a condition of the body that. That involved much more than just the imbalance of humors. And his work was characterized by a systematic examination of the phenomena based on the writers of previous times. He was one of the first physicians to base his work on what people had done before. And again, I point to Ptolemy and Galen simply as examples of this beginning of the scientific method in making real results, real definite results. I mean, one can argue that Plato's results about the putting a mathematical face on structure of matter didn't produce real results. I mean, one could speculate about that all you want, but really, nothing ever came of it. It's not knowledge that could be transmitted and then used. It was more sort of the natural philosophy type of idea. But when you come to Galen or Ptolemy, you had people who were making results that were really usable. For Ptolemy, for example, the idea of the calendar and the repeating cycles of the moon and how that actually worked, he was able to put a mathematical description on it and provided the groundwork for later studies that we'll mention briefly. Galen also provided real results. Results that people could, physicians that trained under him could use to improve the lives of people. And medicine has not always held a perfectly esteemed viewpoint or position in our world. But starting with the scientific study of medicine, it turned out to be more of a respected type of profession. So I want to just mention that in this case, here is in this these two cases is where the scientific method achieves its most important results. That eventually through this system, the truth is going to come out somehow. Now it may take hundreds of years, it may take thousands of years, but eventually you're going to get to the truth by applying this type of method. The investigation, the transmission of the knowledge, in some cases the publication of that knowledge. And the thing about science is that you can either support the claims that you have through repeated investigations, or you can overthrow them. And I think one could argue that science, in this respect, is the only branch of, or only way of knowing that sort of lays the seeds for the overthrow of its precepts. I mean, we, in doing science, we know that we are digging into the unknown. And eventually, we're going to be proved wrong. Maybe. Hopefully not, but you know, I mean, that's part of the game. Hopefully, the reason that you're proved wrong is simply because there's something that's not known yet, that you didn't miss something in your experiment. But in the end, it gives you that sort of assurance that the eventual truth is going to come out. It's going to be modified. Now, the interesting thing about this is that about this time, what we have here is the flourishing, really, of the Christian faith. At about this time, of course, we've got, at the end of the second century, scientific inquiry began to decline as a result of political instability. But in that political instability, we see the Christian faith growing from a very, very small sect on the outskirts of the Roman Empire to the state religion or the state faith in the period of about 300 years. And in that time period, 300 years is not all that long. Based on the communication that existed, the ways people transmitted knowledge, now 300 years is quite a long time. I mean, I think the beginnings of our democracy are on the way to being 300 years old, I think, in this country. But that seems to be a very long time based on the way things have changed since then. But you talk about the ancient world, and 300 years is not that long a time. So what I want to do is just ask the question, based on what we've talked about so far, when I think about the this sort of start sweep of scientific discovery, and I know we've talked about it very generally. Does anybody make the connection between scientific discovery and the Christian faith? Does anybody, what are your thoughts on that? Or are they two separate ideas completely?
I think you'll find in all points of history people using the scientific method in almost all, or many, in any intellectual activity. I think, for instance, you'll find in the Bible examples of people who had one particular religious view of the world, and Jesus came along and did a miracle, and they saw it, and they just had to change their view based on what they observed.
Yeah.
But that's maybe different from the entire, you know, social institution of Western science as it exists now.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree.
Steve, one of the thoughts I had is that when you talked about the irrationality and kind of arbitrariness of the gods creating things, no one disagreed with that. I mean, well, how could you disagree?
Right.
Zeus did it in this. You couldn't. It was a myth. And I don't know how many common people believed in that, but it was still an origin that no one disagreed with because they didn't bring the scientific method to it. The growth of Christianity, but even now, so I shouldn't say it, early days, still submits itself again and again to reason, and sometimes that reason gets used strangely, as we know. But there is scientific. And I don't. Is it right? You have to tell me that if it's the scientific method, but at least there's logic and reason that has to support what in the early Greek time was just accepted, if you want to call it faith or just legend or whatever, but they didn't question it.
Yeah.
Now, religious faith has to hold, lots of the tenets of that religious faith have to hold up to some reasonable thinking. It isn't reasonable that such an, you know, can mm-hmm. different examples.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does, yeah.
Would you rephrase your question? I want to make sure I understood what you asked.
I was just, it's just a very general question that here we have a very important events happening in the history of science at about this time. At the same time, we've got Christianity as moving from a very, very small sect of a limited number of people in a very, very remote area of the Roman Empire into a religion that encompassed the entire known world, at least for the people in it. That's the world that they knew, in a very, very short period of time. The question I asked, which for discussion, was simply, when you think about those two things, are there any connections between them that show up for you?
Well, what I would think of would be just the questioning of the established authority. Now that that there was, you know, this is how the world exists, and this is how, you know, obviously the earth is the center, and now there's people that come along and question that,
right?
And just as they started questioning the Jewish elders, you know, is maybe the Christ the one who was bringing the truth, and what they believed in as far as the law being the truth may not really be the truth. And it's just looking at things with more objectivity.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Well, I wanted to comment about what I told you, Mark. The early church liked that model.
Right.
Hawking's book points it, that's what I read about. And that it left a place out for hell in his model.
Right.
And that impeded, really. They fought. Steve, he probably gets to that later on. They fought certain ideas because it would destroy that concept. At least that, to me, that's the first instance of where the church got involved.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point.
Well, is there any relevance to the fact that theology became the queen of sciences? It was the, for a long period of time, the chief science, and I don't know how they were using the term.
Right.
But it was the way of knowing.
Well, that's
a new way of knowing.
That's an interesting observation, and I'm going to get into that a little bit more later on. But it's a tremendously important part of the whole, actually.
Things I noticed that seems to kind of be a distinction between the two is that And the science, it's dangerous to be a scientist. I mean, it was dangerous for Socrates, it was dangerous for Copernicus, it was dangerous for scientists today, in many ways, to bring new ideas, because it can damage reputation and life and limb. But in theology, the difference there is, in the scientific model, you're trying to approximate an unobtainable truth of some sort. You're trying to nudge your paradigm closer and closer to some sort of, of model that's consistent with what you can observe but can never attain. But in theology, particularly in a period after Galen, when you had somebody that says, we have infallibility, you change the entire, I mean, you force your spiritual truths to have to fit to some model that can't be, that's immutable.
Right.
Whereas in science, you're always questioning what your model is. So
right, you never accept an immutability.
It's a conflict
of the model. Right.
It's not resolved for one.
Right, right. Any further comments on that? Those are all great points, and all of them are really germane to the topic, in that one of the things that's important is that you have this knowledge diffusing through, or this attitude diffusing through the population. And people couldn't help but sort of take on some of that attitude with them, and questioning not only, you know, the origins of the cosmos, but that which people were telling them was true. And that's the point, I think, that you made. And about this time, you know, you had tremendous political instability in the Roman world, the loss of leisure time on the part of upper class resulted in civil war, resulted in lots of economic difficulties, declines in birth rates, loss of slave labor due to plague and warfare, led to a tremendous reduction in the amount of leisure time that people had, people that were going to do these sorts of investigations. And so, and probably the worst possible thing that could have happened is that you had the division of the empire into an eastern half and a western half. The eastern half held on to the Greek. The western half had a language barrier to overcome to have those Greek texts, which were at that time not widely translated, to be able to use them. And so this, at this point, was a tremendous a difficulty for science, because what did we rely on? We relied on the transmission of that knowledge, the transmission of those research results. And so one sees, I think, this tremendous decline in scientific activity, both in the West, especially in the West, but also in the East, for some of the same reasons. Among others, one who was active in spiritual matters, Boethius, about 500, we remember him, of course, as the author of the Consolation of Philosophy, also managed to provide Latin translations of Aristotle's works, and also some of Plato's works, but what one saw was a very limited amount of that huge range of knowledge eventually transmitted into the Western world. And so the common thinking is that, well, okay, there's where we went into the Dark Ages, and there's where we had this loss of learning that was due to the church. As we will see, I think that's not fair, and we'll encounter a couple of examples where people really kept that scientific tradition alive. But one has to remember that the Roman world at this time had really but only a very, very small shell of this the huge body of knowledge that had been built up for 800 years really the only the very beginnings of it, the quote classics, you know, the Timaeus and Aristotle's works on various things. The new results, the things of Plato, of Ptolemy and Galen, wound up being lost to the West for, you know, until really the Renaissance. And so one has to put that fact up against the backdrop of Christianity flourishing at this time. So the standard answer, I think, in that when we think of how the church and how scientific thought were related, is that the church was anti-intellectual and that was an obstacle to the advancement of scientific thought. The consequences, of course, was that, you know, we had Dark Ages rather than Middle Ages. I think that sort of that term Dark Ages is kind of a penalty term that, as I mentioned before, and this, the very term the Renaissance says that that suggests that we have this rebirth of learning, or that we had this great body of knowledge that was reborn at that time, lost and then found again. Which turns out to be, I think, a tremendously powerful story. But what was the real story? And I think that it's important to think about what is, at least in terms of the sort of scholarly activity that was going on, I think what we'll find is that, well, you know, we should be kind of proud of what happened. That it really wasn't something that we should bash the church about. We should be proud of what really happened, even though it wasn't necessarily the optimum state of affairs. So the proposition, of course, is that the church leaders were anti-intellectual and preferred blind faith over reason, for example. But let's think about that for a minute. Christianity, in its early time, appealed initially, of course, to the poor and disenfranchised. The sort of the wealthy people didn't really have much use for it, and that it wasn't something that they felt comfortable with. But really, it quickly reached favor with the upper classes and, of course, along with that, the well-educated. And one of the reasons for that is that if the Bible were to be read widely and for this new faith to grow, the people would have to be able to read it. People would have to be able to talk about it and understand it, their shared tradition. And the church actually ultimately became the major patron of education in that respect. Of course, the kind of learning the church supported, both in research that it patronized or in education, was the type that supported its own mission. But given that, I think that it's important to realize that, in fact, the church did develop a serious intellectual tradition. The so-called apologists were defenders of this new faith against people who were very learned, secular-type people who detracted from it, its theology and its premises. But the interesting thing about it is that the Platonic philosophy, this idea of the prime mover, had to undergo very little change to be used by these apologists to actually have an answer to the detractors. And it's particularly with reference to the Timaeus, the immortality of the soul, the triumph of reason, divine providence, all of these things are contained in the Timaeus, and they prove to be tremendously helpful for the early church. In fact, the demiurge, or the prime mover of Plato's Timaeus, turned out to be more relevant to the monotheistic tradition that they were trying to promote than the pantheon of human-like gods that the the secular or the secular detractors were espousing. So obviously, it's not always a suitable situation. But for example, religious leaders in the ancient city of Carthage suggested that philosophy was heresy, and they disavowed any sort of construction of Christian theology or doctrine out of anything remotely resembling Plato. But really,
you can stay here.
Should I stop? Okay.
Now, those might be different revelations, but if they're both from God, therefore, they both must be true in mm-hmm. some way, shape, or form. And so, and again, going back to basic Aristotelian logic, that they could not contradict one another. And so somehow the book of nature and the book of scripture, let's say, had to complement one another to show God's truth. So in
right.
that sense, science, if they did it right, and that would be, they would show truth. So that the basic issue would be, well, you know, if you would do science and it would contradict scripture, then of course that would be bad science. And so,
right.
you know, back to the laboratory or back to what, right, you know, work it through again, because
right.
if your science and scripture complement one another,
right.
then we know we've got good science.
Right, right. And that's an excellent point, because, again, I think it points to the... What the church was trying to do. I think that people who put a knock on the church in that way would say, well, you know, you did not allow, or the church did not allow science to proceed unfettered. You know, as you said, it was, if it contradicted the teachings, then it was, you know, it'd get back and work it out properly now. But I think if we look at the if we looked at the church to provide an infrastructure and a climate conducive to free inquiry or something like that, I think we're going to be disappointed. But if we acknowledge that the times were tumultuous, and that even proposing the advancement of knowledge and research was a major step forward, based on the lack of access to the Greek sources and just the loss of the time available to do that kind of work, I think that one could argue that the church made a good step forward with what they did to encourage learning and scholarship. But I think we have to remember that the world was an extremely hostile place to live during this crucial period that we're examining. And I remember early on just mentioning that it would be great to be able to, you know, sort of put yourself back in that place and understand what it was like. And I think that's one of the attractions, at least for me, of history. But based on the rise of Christianity, we might expect that the classical tradition would have eventually died out. But in fact, this wasn't the case. The church leaders, in fact, were proud of their classical learning, the learning that they did have. We might have expected that the classical system of education, the schools, might have been replaced by Christian schools focused on a more narrow a system of knowledge. But the fact is, the church leaders, as I said, they valued that. They valued their classical education, and in many instances participated as teachers in these classical subjects. But as someone pointed out earlier, in the 4th century, the rise of monasticism took root in the West, and although the educational program there was mainly focused on the immediate needs of those people living there, Eventually, there arose the practice of reading and commenting on the classical texts as well, and those that were available again in Latin translation. And another point is that, interestingly, it's in the Irish monasteries that we find the most extensive attention to classical studies, especially in the mathematical sciences. They were actually developing these mathematical sciences and actually pushing forward the what was known about mathematics from the Greek text in Latin translation. The forefront of that body of knowledge was available to them, and they expanded on it, which was a tremendously important development. There's another example here. When he retired from public life, Cassiodorus established what was called then as a scriptorium, which was a place to transcribe or translate these texts, and served a tremendously important purpose in the ancient world. In this particular monastery that he founded, he required actually that his monks study a large number of the classical texts. He made it a requirement for them, and of course, he was of the same mind eventually as that other church leaders were, in that the classical texts were useful in supporting church teachings. But the important point about Cassiodorus was that he significantly enlarged the number of texts that were considered useful for that purpose. Prior to that time, it was a very narrow list of these classical texts, perhaps because of the availability issue. But one is reminded, I think, of Thomas Jefferson in that respect, who was criticized when he donated his personal library to the United States Congress because it was too broad in its scope, and that why would a member of the national legislature have any use for these readings on philosophy or readings on mineralogy or anything of this sort. And he was reported to have replied that, well, I can't imagine any branch of knowledge that a member of this assembly would not want to have access to. And so it sort of reminds one of that that wisdom of Jefferson when we think about this gentleman in his monastery. But there's a couple of, and I'll close with this today. We have a couple of examples of people who really, really tried to keep this tradition alive. And one was Isidore of Seville. He became archbishop there in the year 600 and drew on the encyclopedic works that were popular in at this time. People were very, very fond of gathering together all the knowledge that existed, and there's a number of these types of texts that are fascinating, really, to read because they are what our World Book Encyclopedia is to us now. Of course, you can fit it all in one volume there, but not all of it, of course, but a good part of the sort of the scope of learning. He was fond of trying to piece together all the various parts of knowledge. And this list, I'll just read it off because it's fascinating. The classical subjects: grammar, rhetoric, logic, arithmetic, geometry, astronomy, musical theory, medicine, architecture, just the very bare bones of knowledge. And then he expanded his attention to law, timekeeping, which has applications, of course, in the calendar, which turned out to be huge for the Christian faith. Theology, anthropology, geography, cosmology, mineralogy, and agriculture. Now, of course, the amount of knowledge that was fixed, I guess one could say, at that time was relatively small, and an investigator, I think, could be an expert in more than one area, and that's just, it's not so possible anymore. But I think it's pretty amazing that that he was able to at least make an attempt and use his position within the church to promote this sort of knowledge. The last one that I'll mention is Venerable Bede, who at age 7, approximately 750, entered the monastery at Northumbria. And he eventually became the schoolmaster there. And what was interesting about this particular location is that these monasteries were directly descended from the Irish monasteries where this magnificent mathematical work was going on. By virtue of that position, they had access to both learning that was starting to flourish on the continent, and also the work that had been done in the Irish monasteries as well. And it also, along with this, must be remembered, I think, that at this time, communities of scholars were gathering in Oxford and Cambridge. The formal universities weren't founded there until later, but as well as in Paris and in Spain. And so this type of gathering together of people turned out to be very important for the Christian faith, I think. And among his accomplishments, Bede developed fully the science of how one puts together both mathematics and astronomy to develop the calendar. And that turned out to be something that was used well into the Renaissance as part of the legacy, really, of the Christian support, the Christian faith and its support of science. So the question, I guess, is what is our scientific tradition as Christians? I think we should be proud of the early church in that, struggling against persecution and other external forces, the church managed to hold on to the remnants of classical knowledge. And they can't really be faulted for looking with suspicion on classical learning, since first, that world was crumbling or had crumbled around them, and also that the faith that they were clinging to was based on the eternal and not the temporal. So it was natural for them to be a little selective about what they adopted for their use. But one could indeed argue, I think, that they were creating new knowledge as well. I'd like to just close with a quotation from a book by David Lindberg called The Beginnings of Western Science. It's a wonderful book that takes you through from 600 BC to about 1450 AD, and the tremendous scientific work that was going on at that time. What I'd like to just mention about Isidore and Bede, they're fitting representatives of the tradition of popularization and preservation that we've been tracing. Men who struggled to preserve the classical learning and pass it on in usable form to the Christian world of the Middle Ages. But is this tradition worthy of the attention that we give it? Does it merit discussion in a book on the history of early science? If the history of science were simply the chronicle of great scientific discoveries or monumental scientific thoughts, Isidore and Bede would have no place in it. No scientific principles circulate today under their names. However, if the history of science is the investigation of the historical currents that converged to bring us to the present scientific moment, the strands that must be grasped if we are to understand where we came from and how we got here, then the enterprise in which Isidore and Bede were engaged is an important part of the story. Neither Isidore or Bede were a creator of new scientific knowledge, but both restated existing scientific knowledge in an age when the study of nature was marginalized. They provided continuity through a dangerous and difficult period, and in so doing, they powerfully influenced for centuries what Europeans knew about nature and how Europeans thought about nature. Such an achievement may lack the drama of, say, discovering the law of gravitation or devising the theory of natural selection, but to affect subsequent course of European history is no mean contribution. So I think we should feel good about that, and tomorrow we'll sort of take that a little bit forward and investigate some of the current scientific controversies that are afoot in our world today, and hopefully we'll have lots and lots of good discussion on that. So thanks again for coming, and we'll see you tomorrow.